Today is Tuesday, April 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a massive fire engulfs the beloved Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris.
The French president, I think, summed it up for how the whole nation is feeling. He said, a part of us is on fire.
The U.S. Attorney General will release an edited version of the Mueller report on Russian election meddling in the Trump campaign. Also ahead, the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, even in death, is making headlines. It's all on today's International Edition. Less than a week before Easter, amid Holy Week commemorations, a catastrophic fire engulfed the upper reaches of Paris's soaring Notre Dame Cathedral Monday, as it was undergoing renovations. The fire collapsed the cathedral's spire, but the city's mayor later said the firefighters were optimistic they could salvage the main towers from the flames. Built in the 12th and 13th centuries, Notre Dame is the most famous of the Gothic cathedrals of the Middle Ages, as well as one of the most beloved structures in the world. Its architecture is famous for, among other things, its many gargoyles and iconic flying buttresses. As the cathedral continued to burn, hundreds of tourists and Parisians gathered to pray and sing hymns outside of a church across the river from Notre Dame as the flames lit the sky behind them. New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan read part of an email he sent to the Archbishop of Paris.
The people of New York unite with you and the citizens of Paris in sorrow over today's devastating fire. We here love St. Patrick's. It is our spiritual home for people of all faiths. Thus can we but imagine the sadness of your people as they watch their family home of the soul reduced to ashes.
French President Emmanuel Macron was treating the fire as a national emergency, rushing to the scene and straight into meetings at the Paris police headquarters nearby. Joining us now from Paris is reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, first, just talk about the significance of this cathedral.
Notre Dame de Paris is almost a symbol of European culture. It stands for what is European, which is exceptional architecture, exceptional churches, cathedrals. But it goes beyond that because for centuries, Notre Dame de Paris has been a place where Parisians would go, whether in good times or bad. When Paris was liberated after D-Day in 1944, that's where all Parisians went. And when Parisians heard the bells on that day, they knew that meant that Paris had been liberated. Again, if there were other times when people needed to come together, such as after terrorist attacks, this was where Parisians went. So that was why when news came that there was a fire and that it was a very large fire, we could see flames from hundreds of meters away, that people just flocked there because this is Paris. This is the center of Paris. All roads lead to Notre Dame. All the road signs in Paris, the distances, they're all the distance from Notre Dame. So it's part of the city. And even if you're not religious, it has a special meaning just because of that.
And I understand one of the most tragic parts of losing this piece of history and this iconic figure in the city of Paris is the glass.
Word came through from the Paris fire chief that the towers are safe, the bells are safe. But it would seem that these beautiful stained windows, the rose windows, have been damaged by the heat. We're still waiting until daylight to be able to get a proper look at that. We're only getting at this stage photographs from inside of the cathedral where firemen are going in there just to have a look.
This cathedral is probably one of the most iconic places in all of Europe.
It was originally built in the 12th century, so it's seen a lot of wars. It was severely damaged during the French Revolution. It was also damaged during the uprising during the Paris Commune at the end of the 19th century. It is one of the oldest structures in Paris. Been there for so long, it stands there as not just a monument to the Catholic Church, but also architecturally it's very important because it's one of these early Gothic cathedrals where they had to reinforce it. So you've got these flying buttresses that have been put on the cathedral to stop it falling down. So you do get a lot of people coming to Paris to look at the cathedral itself, coming there to worship, but you also get architectural students coming to look at these flying buttresses and to look at how this enormous cathedral was built, and also to work out how such an enormous stone structure can be so light and airy on the inside.
I can imagine people there are devastated. What are people saying? I'm sure they're very emotional about this.
They are very emotional, and in fact the French President Emmanuel Macron came to the Notre Dame de Paris Cathedral late in the evening to thank firefighters and to thank emergency workers who have been on the scene, but he also addressed the nation, and this was a very difficult moment for him. He said that Notre Dame Cathedral is part of French destiny, and he reiterated that the cathedral will be rebuilt, and he was very clear about that, and I think that was a reassurance that people were wanting to hear, that it's not going to be knocked down, that it's going to be rebuilt. He said that he is going to launch a national subscription to get the funds for that, because there's always been this question of who would pay for any renovation work through because of this fire.
They were also in the process of renovating, and now they're going to have to start all over. That's not going to be cheap, I imagine.
It won't. The renovation work's been going on at the cathedral for the last 3 years, and it's been step by step. The actual cathedral itself looks fairly solid, but bits of it keep falling off, and over the years, bits of the gargoyles have fallen off, the spire has fallen off. Now they're going to have to find funding to put all as much as they can back together. That would include the roof, the spire, that 90-meter-high spire that collapsed in the fire. They say that will be rebuilt. And although the French President Emmanuel Macron has said there will be a national subscription, we're also getting reports that one of France's wealthiest entrepreneurs, François-Henri Pinault, his family has pledged 100 million euros towards the rebuilding of Notre Dame. So I think that just goes to show that this is part of French life. French people think that this is theirs. And even though it is a religious building, it's felt that it's part of French heritage, not just a religious building.
The cause of the blaze still not known, but French media quoted the Paris Fire Brigade as saying the fire is potentially linked to a $6 million euro renovation project on the church's spire and its 250 tons of lead. Prosecutors did open an investigation. Some 400 firefighters were battling the blaze well into the night. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. agency plans to invest in businesses that empower African women. Aid and health workers are racing to help Mozambique cyclone victims. Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders releases his tax returns detailing millionaire status. And Iran's growing influence in Venezuela. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Demonstrators in Sudan's capital are defying attempts by the military to break up their ongoing protest and are demanding civilian leadership instead of an army-led transitional government. Naba Mohideen reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Protesters on Monday said troops tried to clear their ongoing sit-in outside army headquarters in Khartoum. But the protesters, who have camped out since the military announced the removal of longtime President Omar al-Bashir last Thursday, refused to move. The protesters are demanding a quicker move to civilian rule in Sudan than the military's announced two-year transition to an elected government. Many, like Ala Salah, are skeptical that the military will hand over power. She said that when Bashir's regime came to power, it was under similar circumstances. They gave promises that they didn't fulfill, says Salah. We need proof, not only talks, she says, and we are staying until our demands are fulfilled. The military's transitional leadership has changed twice since it said Bashir had been placed under house arrest following 4 months of popular demonstrations. The military council on Monday appointed Hashim Abdalmutallab as army chief of staff and said the move was aimed at changing the military. Hashim was appointed by Bashir in February as vice chief of army staff. Some protesters and analysts have questioned whether the military is being truthful when it says Bashir was doubled and arrested. But others, like political analyst Mutasim Ahmad, say the coup was real.
He says trust in the military has won over trust in politics inside the army forces.
The military has considered the situation, says Ahmad, and that's what led to the big sit-in and the success of it. The military council now in charge said Bashir had ordered troops to disperse the sit-in at whatever cost, but the military refused. The protests were triggered in December by food and fuel shortages that saw the price of bread skyrocket. When security forces tried to disperse the protest at army headquarters, troops blocked them, an event that signaled Bashir had lost military support. But protesters remain unconvinced that the military is fully on their side. Monday, the main protest organizers, the Sudanese Professionals Association, called for more people to join the demonstrations and the demands for civilian rule. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
The U.S. Justice Department says it will release Thursday a redacted version of the nearly 400-page report of Special Counsel Robert Mueller on Russia meddling in the 2016 U.S. election aimed at helping Donald Trump win the presidency. Trump claimed again Monday that he has already been exonerated of wrongdoing linked to the election, even as he and the American public await details of the Mueller's 22-month investigation. Joining us to talk about what questions the public should hope to have answered is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, who's also a former CIA officer. Jack, first of all, will we find out why the special counsel didn't make a decision either way on whether or not the president obstructed justice?
We hope we'll find out why he left it the way that he did. Ultimately, Barr exonerated the president when it comes to the obstruction issue. At least that's what he said in his four-page document, his response to this, the boiling down of it. But what it was that Mueller actually wanted is something else. And I think that's one of the issues we're waiting for right now.
Do you suspect that Mueller was looking for something other than the attorney general to just make that decision?
Well, actually, it surprised me that Mueller actually left it to the attorney general. To me, it felt like he punted. I feel like Mueller's the one who ran this investigation for 22 months. It was more than 400 pages. He had dozens of agents looking at this. Millions of dollars was spent. If anybody understands what it is that the government knew, what it is that the president may or may not have done, what any of his followers may or may not have done, it would be him. He should have been the one who made the decision.
I've also heard that someone like Mueller, there has to be a good reason why he didn't make the decision. Do you think that Mueller possibly did mean for it to be a decision Congress made?
I think if Mueller wanted Congress to make the call on this issue, he would have been very clear on this. If we look at the Attorney General himself, he's been more than clear about his position on the investigation, on the president, and his willingness to support that president. His 19-page document that he wrote personally of his own opinions on this issue is more clear than just about anything else we could ever get. You compare that to the four pages that he ultimately presented subsequently, simply seem to reflect what those 19 pages said earlier, plus a little bit from Mueller.
What else do you think we should be looking for with the release of the redacted report?
I think what's particularly critically important here is exactly what the president and his team was doing. Because even if it doesn't rise to the level of a crime, that doesn't mean that it's not critically important to understand. If the standard is literally, you can't indict me, that's not the same thing as exoneration. And so what we really need to understand is exactly what happened, what the failures were, what the efforts were by those who may have been involved, and whether it actually rose to the standard. And if it didn't, how close did it get? It's a political question for the American people.
Congress is continuing to demand the full unredacted report, saying Barr has a legal authority to give them everything. They have the legal authority to have it, including classified information. They do that that all the time without necessarily going to the public. But it sounds like Congress and the public are getting the exact same thing with redactions of things that Barr doesn't feel are appropriate for Congress or the public to see.
Apparently, Barr is redacting grand jury information, classified information, material about ongoing operations, and material affecting peripheral third parties. Again, all of those issues could go to certain members of Congress without any redactions whatsoever. That's, in fact, what the House is demanding at this point. And by the way, rightfully so. They are an equal member of government, and their obligation is to stand up as an equal member of government and make those demands. We will see what the Attorney General does.
A lot of accusations against Barr about his impartiality or lack thereof.
Let's face it, the Attorney General has been very clear about his position during the nomination process, and what he said very clearly was that he would be loyal to the president here. His approach seems to be that of defending the president, not defending the American people. You have to accept that that is his position. And if that is his position, anything that he says should be weighed.
All right. That is former CIA officer, current criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Meanwhile, two House committees have subpoenaed Deutsche Bank and several other financial institutions as part of investigations into President Trump's finances. And part of the investigation, including into allegations of potential foreign influence on the U.S. political process. Investigations are among several that House Democrats are conducting into aspects of the president's personal and political life. Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, has formally declared his candidacy for president in the 2020 election, joining a crowded field of Democratic hopefuls. Buttigieg was virtually unknown on the national political landscape just a few months ago, but is now surging in recent polls. VOA's Esha Sarai has more.
My name is Pete Buttigieg. They call me Mayor Pete. I'm a proud son of South Bend, Indiana, and I am running for president of the United States.
37-year-old Pete Buttigieg is a graduate of Harvard and Oxford. He's an Afghanistan war veteran, and he speaks seven languages.
Bonjour, je suis Pete Buttigieg de South Bend, Indiana. Ahlan wa sahlan, ana Pete Buttigieg, reis medani fi Medinat South Bend, Indiana. Salam, Pete Buttigieg Heston.
If elected, he would be America's youngest president. But at a recent appearance in New Hampshire, he said his message, which is focused on the future of the nation, appeals to all demographics.
We're also seeing people my parents' age who would love nothing more than to support the kind of generational change that's going to keep our eyes on those issues that are going to matter in the future.
Buttigieg would also be America's first openly gay president. His husband, Chasten, has also won over many American voters.
And as for my husband, obviously I'm pretty biased because I love him, but it's pretty great to see that the rest of America is starting to fall in love with him, too.
What Buttigieg lacks is political experience on the national stage. He currently serves as mayor of South Bend, a city of just over 100,000 people. But his supporters don't seem to care.
I mean, he's been a mayor for almost 8 years now. I think the executive experience is valuable for the executive branch. And I think in terms of legislative experience, he could have help from his team for that.
See, even though he doesn't have national experience, he has executive experience as a mayor of a city. And I just feel like he connects with a lot of his constituents very well.
Buttigieg has been surging in recent polls in key states and has raised a respectable $7 million in the first quarter. Whether he can sustain that momentum is yet to be seen.
Sometimes candidates have a few weeks or a few months of stardom, and then another candidate replaces them. So I think we know that he's viable. I don't think we know at this point that he's going to be a star in the field.
Over the next year, Buttigieg must compete with at least 18 other Democrats vying to become the party's nominee to unseat President Donald Trump in 2020. Esha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
President Donald Trump again on Monday took aim at Muslim junior Democratic Representative Ihan Omar for her comments about the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He also took a swipe at House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for defending the Somali-American lawmaker. Associated Press reporter Sagar Magani has details.
Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar has accused the president of fomenting right-wing extremism, saying she's faced increased death threats after he retweeted a video purportedly showing her dismissing the 9/11 attacks. This morning, the president tweets, Omar makes anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, and ungrateful U.S. hate statements. He's also going after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who says she's asked Capitol Police to review Omar's safety. The president says Pelosi's lost all control of Congress, and before she decides to defend Omar, she should look at Omar's past comments. Sagar Mangani, Washington.
New York City has declared a public health emergency amid an alarming spike in the number of measles cases among largely unvaccinated children. VOA's Carol Pearson looks at why these parents are reluctant to vaccinate in the face of serious measles outbreak.
It's this ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in New York City where measles has been spreading since last October. The outbreak prompted Mayor Bill de Blasio to declare a public health emergency.
We have a situation now where children are in danger.
De Blasio ordered mandatory vaccinations in the neighborhoods where Orthodox Jewish families live. Unvaccinated children will not be allowed to attend school, and their parents may face steep fines. There are no religious reasons preventing Orthodox parents from vaccinating their children. But working with religious leaders is key to ending the outbreak.
We've worked closely with the community, religious leaders, and schools to make sure that vulnerable people are kept safe during this outbreak and to challenge the dangerous misinformation that is being spread by a group of anti-vaxxers.
The ParCare Community Health Network caters to Orthodox families. VOA spoke with its president shortly after the mayor's declaration.
Up until now, some of them were undecided.
Now, Gary Schlesinger says those parents will get their children vaccinated, or the administrators of the private religious schools they attend have told him they will abide by the emergency declaration.
They were very clear that they will unequivocally deny any parent who does not vaccinate their children.
Schlesinger says about 100 families in this tight-knit community of about 100,000 are personally against vaccinations, citing misinformation that vaccines are connected with autism or even death. Some of the same reasons people in other non-religious communities give for not vaccinating their children. All false information.
It really is an incredibly safe vaccine. We've been using it since the 1960s in this country, and it has an outstanding safety record.
Measles outbreaks across the country are now surging at near record levels. More than 400 cases in 19 states just this year, according to the CDC. Why measles? It's incredibly infectious. Outbreaks can also be a sign that children aren't being vaccinated against other deadly diseases as well. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. President Donald Trump says he'll present the Presidential Medal of Freedom to legendary golfer Tiger Woods, who just captured his fifth Masters Championship. It's his 15th major professional victory after an 11-year drought from winning the sport's biggest tournaments.
If you look at it, my first 14 wins in majors were always, I had the lead in every one of them, or tied for the lead. to have the opportunity to come back like this, it is probably one of the biggest wins I've ever had, for sure.
Woods, with a big smile on his face, thrust both arms into the air as he holed his final putt on the 18th green for a bogey. He hugged his mother, his two children, and other well-wishers as he headed to the clubhouse to sign his scorecard. At the age of 43, he is the oldest Masters champion since Jack Nicklaus won the 1986 Masters at 46. Aretha Franklin is still getting respect, even after death. The Queen of Soul received the Pulitzer Prize Special Citation Honor Monday, becoming the first individual woman to earn a Special Citation Prize since the honor was first awarded in 1930. The Pulitzer Board said the award was given to Franklin for her indelible contribution to American music and culture for more than five decades. Franklin, who sold millions of records, died on August 16th at her home in Detroit from pancreatic cancer at the age of 76. The superstar musician was the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame when she entered the prestigious organization back in 1987. Franklin's inclusion into the exclusive club here reconfirms the impact her music and voice had and continues to have on the world. She became a cultural icon and genius of American song, considered by many to be the greatest popular vocalist of her time. Her voice transcended age, category, and her own life. And you have been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Aretha Franklin.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm